Please be seated. Our case for argument today is 24-1324, Natera v. NeoGenomics Laboratories. Ms. Maynard, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court, Deanne Maynard for NeoGenomics. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The preliminary injunction removing NeoGenomics' cancer detection test from the market should be set aside for multiple independent reasons, including because substantial questions exist on obviousness and on whether RaDaR infringes the properly construed claims, and because the public interest in access to this unique and highly sensitive cancer detection test outweighs any harm to Natera. I'd like to start with obviousness. So the claims here are just three steps: tagging, amplifying, and sequencing cell-free DNA. All of these steps were known before the...
In particular, but still,
Your Honor, in ways that were known in the art. So the CAPR reference, our primary reference, teaches basically all of the steps. And the only...
Except for the input.
So the question is whether...
Is that right?
Except for the input, meaning except for using the method on cell-free DNA.
Exactly.
If that's what you mean. Yes, Your Honor. That was the only element the district court found missing. But that element, too, is known in the art. And Natera's previous admissions in this court and in other courts in other cases and the prior art make clear that applying basic cell-free DNA processing steps to circulating cell-free DNA was routine and conventional.
Ms. Maynard, I guess here's my problem. I completely understand what you're saying. I have no doubt amplifying cell-free DNA was known. Tagging cell-free DNA was known. The problem is there's a bunch of evidence here that this court relied on, and we reviewed under the clear error standard. And that evidence suggests that there were lots of problems with cfDNA in terms of the fragmentation, the lower yields, that would make it unsuitable for using it in this CAPR assay, that would make it such that a skilled artisan would not be motivated to substitute it in and use it for this purpose. So even if cell-free DNA, people knew how to amplify it, people knew how to tag it, people knew how to do these things, one-off things with it, there's a difference between doing those one-off things and choosing to substitute the cell-free DNA in CAPR in that particular fluid something assay. I don't remember what it's called.
Fluidimarine assay.
Okay, yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the issue, and it's clear error review for us. So what do we do with that?
So I think 2 points in response to your question, Your Honor. First, I think at bottom, even accepting the district court's findings
about... Hold on just 1 second. John Paul, I might be crazy, but it feels really dark in here to me. Is there any way to turn the lights up? I know these things are on dimmers. Maybe they're not all on. Am I the only person that thinks it seems a little dark?
Yeah. I feel the same.
I'm a little... Yeah, thank you. Let there be light. Go ahead.
So 2 points in response to your question, Your Honor. One is, even accepting the district court's findings on obviousness and the obstacles that might exist with respect to applying CAPR to cell-free DNA, even accepting those, on this legal standard that applies here, which is, did Natera show a lack of a substantial question of obviousness on this record, on the unrebutted facts and their own admissions, the answer to that is no, they did not. Because...
Well, but you have to prove motivation to combine in order to say there is obviousness, or Natera has to show that there wasn't likely a motivation to combine. And that's what this seemed to all hinge on for the district court, I think.
So, well, the way that I read the district court's opinion, Your Honor, is that it actually turned more on reasonable expectation of success, and that even Natera concedes that there was the classic motivation to use this for cancer detection, that was the same way in which what CAPR was doing, that was the motivation in CAPR, and our expert testified that persons of skill in the art would be motivated to use this on cell-free DNA for cancer detection.
Yes, to use cell-free DNA in cancer detection, but that's a really broad thing. Is there a motivation to use cell-free DNA in this particular Fluidigm access array assay? I don't know if I'm saying that right.
Yes, Your
because
Honor.
Because, you know, of the lack of sort of precision in using the cell-free DNA, that made it such that whether you want to frame it as a question of motivation to combine or frame it as a question of likelihood of success, it almost doesn't matter. I read the district court's use of the word precision as very much going to this question of whether somebody would have substituted cell-free DNA in this CAPR assay in light of the limitations of using it that were articulated on pages 9 and 10 of the district court opinion.
And I will address the evidence that shows that we created a substantial question of invalidity framed that way, Your Honor. I do think it was error for the district court to rely on with precision, since with precision is an unclaimed feature
claims. I will, with all due respect, you have no chance of winning on that with me. You have a chance of winning here, but not with that. And the reason you have no chance of winning with that is because I don't read that as going to claim construction at all. I found their brief quite persuasive on the point that that was the court saying, would a skilled artisan be motivated to take cell-free DNA when it lacks precision and insert it into this test? And that's the way I read the opinion. So if you want to spend any of your very short time on that, feel free, but you will not prevail on that.
I've noted my argument, and I will address Your Honor's questions about the record evidence. So the record evidence shows, and their own prior admissions show, that someone would be motivated and expect to have reasonable success applying a similar assay to CAPR to cell-free DNA. And as one of many examples, the 2010 Fluidigm application, which is in the record, it's prior art, describes similar DNA processing steps using a device like CAPRs for tagging and amplifying cell-free DNA. That's in volume 3, A13097, paragraph 122. It shows that Fluidigm, which is the same company behind CAPR, Your Honor, the Fluidigm array, can be used on any fluid, including blood, and at A13103, paragraph 176, for the purpose of diagnosing cancer. So again, Fluidigm is the same company behind CAPR.
Was this cited to the district court?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where?
Where did we cite Fluidigm?
No, I want to know if the district court judge had notice of this particular passage in the Fluidigm publication such that the judge could evaluate it and understand whether this was possibly enough to raise a substantial question.
I can give you the pinpoint site when I come back on rebuttal, if that's okay, Judge Chen, but this was a key feature of our expert declaration.
She's talking.
I'm sorry, where in the joint appendix?
I'm sorry, I'm pointing to 2010 Fluidigm application, Your Honor, which is volume 3, A13097.
I guess I just had a broader...
I don't think that was in the relevant four paragraphs of your 103 argument on 035.
Well, so the district court also looked to our expert declaration, Your Honor, and Van Nest, our expert, discussed both the prior art, which is...
Not in any of the pages or paragraphs, as far as I can tell, cited on this crucial point in your four paragraphs on 035.
So both parties in the district court, Judge Toronto, litigated this largely through the expert reports. The district court found fault with that with respect to other arguments, but not with respect to the obviousness argument. And the district court addressed Van Ness and our declaration and Metzger and their declaration.
Well, I guess that's the question, which is, if the judge was on notice, obviously, of this Fluidigm publication and was on notice of the entire Metzger reply declaration in the Illumina IPR, is the judge required to look through all of those materials before reaching a conclusion on substantial question of validity? Or is it really fair for the district court to just consult the actual paragraphs of various documents that you cited in your opposition to the PI and then go from there? So, for example, for the Van Ness declaration you were talking about, your op cited paragraphs 241 to 248. And in 241 to 248, I don't see anything about the Fluidigm publication, for example.
That was Exhibit 13, which is not cited. Okay.
And so this raises a question. Your briefing raises a lot of interesting quotes from a lot of different documents, including the Metzger Declaration, the Fluidigm, on and on and on. But if those aren't actually contained in the cites in your opposition to the PI, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do about that and think about that. I mean, maybe for purposes of the final merits, you can raise all of that, but for the limited purpose of trying to figure out whether the judge here clearly erred, would it be inappropriate for me to be looking and scouring through the entire record like you have done very well to then conclude that the district court clearly erred?
So 2 points, Your Honor. One, they haven't argued waiver of this issue on appeal. Two, the district court looked through all the materials and addressed the party's expert declarations. Our expert declaration cites it in her opinion and cited their expert declarations. We had a long hearing, and our slides are in the JA that we presented to the district court at the oral argument on this issue, which calls out a lot of these same pieces of evidence that our slides are of the PI hearing begin at Appendix 21068 in Volume 4. And the slides call out and address many of the same evidence that we are featuring in our appeal brief. So the judge was definitely on notice, Your Honor. And I don't think it's just purely a factual question. The question is abuse of discretion in granting a preliminary injunction has both a legal aspect and a factual aspect to it. And the question is whether there's a substantial question of invalidity on this record. And there is. I mean, the judge heard oral argument, and we presented all this evidence and called it out and put up these slides on the screen and talked to her about it. She was clearly on notice. She did, as I say, fault NeoGenomics on other invalidity
arguments. Can you tell me where that slide is that you say that she had in front of her? What page number you said that was on that contained this information?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I was giving you the first page of our slide, which is A21068.
What volume?
Oh, it's Volume 4. She did more. And so we do discuss the Fluidigm patent application.
I'm on 21068. So these are slides that you, don't worry about time. We're not, okay. This is not going to be a 15-minute case. Okay. So 21068.
I was just giving you the first page, Your Honor.
So where would the thing be that you say should have drawn to the judge's attention your argument about Fluidigm, and in particular, I think it was a patent on pages 13098.
So we have slides about the Fluidigm patent and make the point that we make.
Where, what page?
I'm sorry. It's on page A, starts 21105. It shows a picture of their expert, Dr. Metzger. It says Fluidigm teaches 9216 targets. This is our point about their claim here in this court that multiplexing in a single volume reaction is their primary invention, but Dr. Metzger admitted that in another case that the Fluidigm 2010 application teaches a single volume reaction with over 9,000.
Okay, now you're switching points.
Yes, I am.
Just get me to the finish line on the first point because
right.
I'm not there yet.
Understood. So we pick up,
21106, 21105, where am I supposed to see that you have directed the district court to pages 13097 and 13098, which is a patent. I think it's a patent. Application? Okay, patent application.
So starting on page A21127, we have portions of Dr. Metzger's Illumina declaration, Judge Chen, where we point out that this is a quote from the slide on A21127. It was further well known by 2008 that one could isolate, amplify, and sequence cell-free genomic DNA. I'm looking, Your Honor. I wasn't expecting to be addressing a waiver argument since they haven't.
Paragraph 116. That first sentence is what you think should have alerted the court to this argument about. Your argument is that the district court erred in having all of these concerns about the use of cell-free DNA because of its fragmentation, because of the lower yields, all of these different documents that the district court cited, which all went clearly in my mind to both motivation to consent, motivation to combine and reasonable expectation of success. And you're saying that was clear error because we pointed the district court to this other thing. And the district court didn't address the other thing in the opinion. So I'm wondering, is that a flaw in the district court's part, or did you really present this other thing to the district court? And I'm still struggling to see where you presented the other thing to the district court. And this doesn't go to waiver, Ms. Maynard. It goes to whether or not the district court abused its discretion and therefore clearly erred in its fact findings. And if you didn't raise this argument to it, if you didn't show it this, how can I conclude it clearly erred?
So, court's indulgence, Your Honor, while I clarify the site.
I do find this paragraph 116 interesting. Was it in fact presented in front of the judge during the hearing where?
I'm sorry, Judge Shin, I've lost the thread. What paragraph 116?
The 116, the Metzger Declaration in the Illumina IPR, where you said it, you know, you quoted it was well known by 2008, one could, oh my gosh, isolate, amplify, and sequence cell-free genomic DNA, and it further goes on, as such, one of skill would have had a reasonable expectation of success in using cell-free DNA from maternal blood in a multi-step PCR method, such as Fluidigm's. So,
yes, Your Honor. Our expert, Van Ness, explained in his declaration explaining the prior art, and the declaration was before the district court and was attached to our opposition to the PI motion.
This isn't in paragraphs 241 to 247 of Van Ness's declaration, so that's why I'm curious to know. I see we have a slide deck here, but was this particular paragraph from the Metzger Declaration of the Illumina IPR actually walked through in front of the judge during the hearing? I mean, this paragraph basically says, you know, Dr. Metzger basically opines that a skilled artisan would have a reasonable expectation of success in running cell-free DNA through Fluidigm's PCR scheme.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's part of our argument, and was our argument to the district court as well, that Natera had previously taken So in Dr. Van Ness, our expert's declaration, which appears at A12101 in paragraph 265, he discusses the Fluidigm patent application 2010. It's volume 2, A12101.
Okay.
All right, but that cites only paragraph 88, which is not the paragraph that you were pointing us to, was it?
So before, at the end of that paragraph, Judge Tronto, he also refers back to his previous discussion of Dr. Metzger having previously argued this very reference rendered obvious a large-scale multiplex PCR method, which goes to the... In our brief in the district court, we cite to that paragraph on page, so it's our district court brief on page 11 of our district court brief at the end of our obviousness discussion.
Any idea where I can find that in the appendix?
It's appendix 10490, Your Honor.
Do you know what volume?
Volume 2.
That's only for the number of plexings, as you call it, not for anything else.
Yeah, that paragraph is about the number of plexings, Your Honor. But
and that's really the way people talk? Plexings? Anyway. But no, go on.
Yeah.
The problem is that the citations in this kind of four-paragraph argument are thin, and the points made about them are not really expressly explained. So you have to do this, first of all, hunting to what is cited, and now apparently supplementation of what was not cited. And that's the challenge. This is what is the Fourth Circuit sometimes refers to, a passing shot. Is not enough.
But again, Your Honor, the parties largely did, like, their brief is also thin on this point, and they relied for their burden on their expert declaration as well. And when the district court decided it, she cited both their expert and our expert, so she was clearly, like, studying the expert opinions. And these things were attached, like the Fluidigm 2010 application was attached.
Were all of these PowerPoint slides walked through in kind of the way that seems to be common before the patent board, or is this, here's a stack and we're going to talk about some of them?
No, the hearing oral argument, which is also in the JA, Your Honor, you can read through the hearing and you can walk through the slides, and we did show these slides to the district court. And we did the presentation with the district court by walking through the slides.
Just to continue, so you did point to a slide with paragraph 116 of Metzger's IPR presentation. Is there also a slide with the paragraph of the paradigm application that you want to rely on?
Of the Fluidigm application, Your Honor?
Fluidigm, sorry.
Yeah. Just a moment. So, I mean,
do you want to look for it and come back up on rebuttal and address it?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor. I mean,
How about we move to the public interest? Because I know you wanted to address that, and I have questions about it. So do you mind? If there's more you want to say on obviousness, please do.
Well, the 2010 Fluidigm application is not the only evidence in the record, nor the only evidence pointing to the district court that shows that Natera previously has taken the position that it's routine and conventional to apply these types of cell-free processing steps. And again, the claims are just basic cell-free processing steps to cell-free DNA. And Natera has twice convinced this court that it was routine and conventional to do so. And so the notion, and at this point too, our burden is only to show that there is a substantial question of obviousness, not to actually like finally prove it. So even if you believe it's not completely certain whether we will win, that isn't the standard.
The problem you have is at this point, your burden is actually to prove the district court clearly erred in the fact findings on motivation to success and reasonable expectation. Motivation to combine and reasonable expectation of success. That's your burden. The burden you're articulating about substantial question or vulnerability, that's the overall burden. But the district court found specific facts wanting, and that's how it came to its conclusion.
Except that I do think at some level, Your Honor, it is a legal question. Like under Amazon.com, at some level, even accepting her findings, given the strength of this record, that there is a substantial question of obviousness. But even taking Your Honor's framework that it is a clear error standard, all the district court found is that there were obstacles, but the evidence overwhelmingly shows, including admissions from Natera, that those obstacles, whatever they were not deterring other people from doing it. And in fact, the Forshoe 2012 publication that they point to as evidence of Radar's infringement of their claims is evidence of contemporaneous independent invention that...
So I was just sort of struck by that. When I read, to the extent I could understand, which I'm sure is not 100%, I took away from that Forshoe and company thought they had made a really significant advance. Made me think, maybe this is actually helping the other side. And then I was wondering, when is the last time we gave weight as a secondary consideration against obviousness to this contemporaneous invention? I'm not sure when it is.
The case we rely on is a Supreme Court case, which suggests that it's relevant to obviousness that somebody independently, even assuming what they've done is an invention, that somebody independently invented it roughly around the same time.
Right, but there are at least two, problems that I've thought about over time. One is that somebody might not be an ordinarily skilled artisan, might be a super artisan or something.
Flash of genius.
Yeah. And second, it's really hard, at least has been for me over the years, to square this notion with the patent law's encouragement of patent races with extremely precise priority dates. So this seems to me like it's a bit of an uphill legal battle to make Forshoe, an assistant for you.
So Dr. Forshoe is the Inivata, one of the Inivata co-founders, which is now a subsidiary of our client. And it does show that there was independent invention because the article was accepted for publication before they even filed their patent, which they didn't file until after our product became public.
That article expressly also acknowledges the fragmentation and the low yield of cfDNA. The article itself, while may offer a form of independent invention, does so by articulating the framework of how difficult it was to come to the conclusion that the cfDNA could be used that way.
But the prior art shows that difficulty, Your Honor, not only that the other Fluidigm 2010 and the Natera admissions and CareDx and Illumina show that those obstacles, whatever they are, were not deterring persons of skill in the art from applying these basic DNA processing methods to cell-free DNA. And nothing in these claims claims any kind of overcoming of those obstacles. So these claims are just basic DNA processing step claims. They don't claim anything that they did to overcome these obstacles.
Would you like to move on? You wanted to talk about public interest, and I actually want to hear that argument. So can you move on to that at this point?
I can, Your Honor. Okay. So I'll just give you one site, the slide to Fluidigm and Metzger, where we talked to the district court about the Illumina declaration. That was A21127. So yes, Your Honor, I would like to talk about public interest because here...
21127?
21127.
21127.
In volume 4.
Oh, that's the slide itself that we've already been looking at.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Is there...
The slide has a citation to where it was argued.
We have a copy of the transcript, right?
Yeah, the transcript is in the JA, Your Honor. Yes, the transcript...
So I thought you were citing to me something in the transcript that was discussing this particular slide.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll find that on rebuttal.
I'm sorry.
Yes, Your Honor.
So 21127 shows paragraph 116 of Metzger's IPR declaration. That's not the Fluidigm application, is it?
In Metzger's Illumina declaration, which is in volume 3 at A13.
No, we want to know, this is the slide you presented to the district court. So tell us what's on this slide.
All right.
Is it on this slide? Because I'm not going to go hunting and pecking for more stuff that wasn't before the district court.
So the Illumina Declaration is a declaration Dr. Metzger, their expert, submitted in support of obviousness. So the one early approach, like the last sentence, one early approach was to isolate nucleic fetal cells from maternal blood. Though because of the rarity of the blood. I'm on the wrong page, he said.
So okay. Here and then this one too.
So these two slides. So in the middle of the slide on 127, cell-free genome DNA from maternal blood had also previously been successfully amplified and sequenced. And the topic sentence of this paragraph is it was further well known by 2008 that one could isolate, amplify, and sequence cell-free genomic DNA. And the yellow highlighting was the yellow highlighting on the slide.
Just to be clear, and she could be wrong, but my clerk says none of the exhibits cited on this page are to the Fluidigm patent application. Do you contradict that?
On this page, that's correct, Your Honor. This is the site to this is a more support, different support, cite to Dr. Metzger, their expert's declaration he put in.
But he cites exhibit 10006, exhibit 1005. Even that sentence you just read is exciting to exhibit 1006 abstract and exhibit 1013 abstract. And so I have no idea what those are, but my law clerk just suggested that her review would show that none of them are the Fluidigm patent application. And is there a reason to think that's inaccurate?
No, but I don't know whether that's accurate or not. I don't have any reason to believe it isn't, but that's not our point on these pages. This is a separate piece of admission by them. So just to take a step back, our obviousness case is that Caper discloses all of the steps and that it was known in the art to apply those steps to cell-free DNA. And as this court has held in lots of contexts.
I thought, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe I misunderstood. Okay. I thought Judge Chen had asked you where you cited the Fluidigm patent application to the district court. I thought you pointed us to this page. I thought you were walking through this as part of that same discussion. I guess I'm wrong and I'm off base. And so that's what I was trying, when you said, see, it says cell-free, da, 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 I thought you were saying, and that is a reference to the Fluidigm patent application.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Didn't mean to be suggesting that.
Confused.
I thought I was answering a different question for Judge Chen, which is, was the Illumina declaration that Dr. Metzger filed in the Illumina IPR presented to the district court. So we have multiple different places where Natera has conceded that it is routine and conventional. And this Illumina declaration is one of them where their expert has said it is routine and conventional well before the priority date. This was an obviousness case as well, not a 101 case, this PTAB case. So this is a declaration from their expert in a previous case conceding it was well known and routine. So this declaration is talking about Fluidigm, Your Honor.
Can you please move on to the public interest? Public interest. Can you
May
move
I have
on?
One?
No.
Move I want to correct something I said to you, Your Honor, which is this declaration is talking about the Fluidigm 2010 declaration. So the sites are to a different case. So this is his previous
declaration. You say this declaration is talking about it. What you presented to the district court is a single portion of a paragraph from the declaration, and none of the sites in that are there to the Fluidigm patent application. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor, that's not correct. Okay. These are our hearing slides. These are just PowerPoint slides that were put up. The Dr. Van Ness's declaration includes talking about Dr. Metzger's Illumina declaration. It includes
the entire Fluidigm 2010. Four paragraphs. Oh, just move on to public interest, please.
Yes, Your Honor. So there's significant patient interest here. They have not disputed that our test can be used for cancers that their test cannot.
The district court expressly held that was not accurate or had not been established in terms of clinical validity. Is that correct in the denial of the stay? I don't remember what page it's on.
No, Your Honor. The district court in denying the stay was talking about our claims of sensitivity, which Natera does dispute. So the district court said, and I think what you're referencing is the district court's comment in the stay denial that the evidence was not at all clear that our test was more sensitive than their test. But it was that the district court was
okay,
not.
Wait. Sorry. Let's read it. It's on page 21325 and 21326. Do you have it?
I will.
We'll start at the bottom of 21325. When you have it, let me know.
All right. Thank you. I'm with you, Your Honor.
21325. NeoGenomics contends that radar has a higher sensitivity than Natera's product and allows it to better detect cancer at early stages. But that point is disputed and not at all clear that this is so. Here's the more important one. Nor has NeoGenomics submitted satisfactory evidence that its radar test is available for cancers for which Natera's product is not available. So that looks like it is, in fact, a fact-finding that I said he made that you said he did not make, and he only made a fact-finding, or she only made a fact-finding with regard to sensitivity.
I agree that question goes to the point I was making. So I stand corrected on that, Your Honor. This is not the PI ruling. This is her stay. This is her stay denial.
Yes, this is her stay denial.
This is her stay denial. In the PI ruling, she made no such fact, and to the extent that is a factual assertion, it's clearly erroneous. And that the record does show, and our expert, we have an executive affidavit from our company saying that our test can be used for cancers that their test cannot, including blood cancers.
Vishal Sikri is the name of the person. I've read it in detail. He has 20 years of experience in oncology, and he is now the president of one of your company's divisions. So I certainly read his testimony very closely. But he asserts that yours is more sensitive and also can be used for different kinds of cancer, potentially, but I can't find any evidence to support that. I can't find any evidence at all anywhere that says that your test, for example, has received FDA approval or is otherwise available to be used to treat any kind of cancer that their product cannot be used for. So if I'm mistaken, I would love for you to walk me through it, because I will tell you, I made my poor clerk spend her entire weekend trying to figure out if there was evidence about which kinds of cancer yours could be used for or was approved to be used for, and which kinds of cancers theirs could be used for or was approved to be used for. Because this was a very confusing case, and there are a lot of conclusory assertions about things like this, but I'm really interested in finding the evidence.
So it's important to make a framing point, Your Honor, which is there's two ways, as their expert acknowledges, there's two different ways that products like this are used. And one is by pharmaceutical partnerships for research, and the other is clinicians' use. And so here the district court did find that the two were clinically validated for the same cancers, but that's for commercial use for patients.
So right. For patients, wait, I just want to make sure I understand this. So from a public interest standpoint, it's not the case that your test is available for use for patients for different forms of cancer that their tests could not be used for also.
The district court said they were clinically validated for the same uses, but we had evidence, including from two doctors, which is the only evidence in the record of people who've actually used both tests, saying that ours was more sensitive and would be better for certain kinds of cancer. So Dr.
What do you mean
Weiss,
with two doctors who said this? Where is the evidence?
Dr. Weiss's wrote a letter. It's volume 2A.
Who are you talking about?
His name is Dr. Beisch, Beitsch.
Did you cite this in your brief to us?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, where in your brief? Because I want to see where the argument is made. I mean, I think this argument is around pages 49-ish of your blue brief, if that helps.
Yes, thank you.
And are you talking about the blood and bone marrow cancers at the bottom?
No, so the blood and bone marrow cancers are the kinds of cancers that that our executive explained, the one that you looked at, explained that it can be used for, and he does discuss, so just to go back to your first question, at volume 2, A11, 283, in paragraphs 35 and 36, he discusses a radar trial for one of those kinds of cancers that Signatera can't use.
I knew you were going to get to this. Let me just make it, I want to make sure you know that I understand where you're going. So there's two types of public interest here. Public interest number one is actually treating real patients who have tumors and want to detect if they're coming back. And that's what I'm trying to focus on. I know there's a separate public interest, and I promise you we will get to it. And the second public interest is clinical trials that further advance the utilization of these tools. And so please understand that I know that those both exist, but I'm trying to understand what evidence there is in bucket number one, which is actual patient use. Are there patients being deprived of using a test that Natera's test is not a substitute for?
So the blue brief at page 50, like in the paragraph that asserts other evidence is similarly compelling, the likewise sentence. Likewise, a prominent oncologist familiar with both radar and Signatera attested by letter that radar's established high sensitivity is important for studying some cancers, including melanoma and certain breast cancers. And that's the site to his letter. And in his letter...
Where can I find this letter?
It's in volume 2. It's A11... 264 and 65.
Well, you cite 11265, so should I go there, maybe?
It's a two-page letter.
Okay.
And he also talks about there how he uses it with patients, and he finds it more valuable. And that's the patient harm choice,
Hold on.
Your Honor.
Hold on. With all due respect, choice is not a harm if the two things are equal.
Well, this letter says that they are not, and then this...
With all due respect, I don't understand. How has he established that one is more sensitive than the other? This is just a letter. Hey, I found something more sensitive than something else.
He's saying he prefers to use it for certain types of cancers. And
why?
It's the best kind of...
Why?
Hang on, I haven't caught up with you.
Yes, he says at the top of 11265.
Radar is more sensitive than Signatera to detect circulating tumor DNA levels because of its established analytical sensitivity, especially in low-shedding cancers such as melanoma.
But this is a guy who just says it. Where is the proof? No, how would he know it's more sensitive? He's a doctor. He's not a researcher who has done a study that showed one compared to the other, some head-to-head study. Look, there's evidence in this record that your client's been out there telling people yours is more sensitive than theirs. Maybe that's how he heard it.
Where is the proof? He explains how he knows this. This is the best possible evidence. Somebody who actually uses it with patients. In my current practice treating patients with breast cancer and melanoma, I use MRD assays for cancer monitoring and routinely use tumor MR. They have no evidence, Your Honor, no head-to-head studies that it's not more sensitive. And we have the only evidence in the record of somebody who actually uses both. And says that this one can be used, ours can be used for some things, or better for some things than theirs is. And on a preliminary record, it's in the public interest to call any doubt in favor of patient choice. The question is whether we should remain on the market.
It's not patient choice. It's only patient choice in light of an existing patent if there's a likelihood of success, if there is a benefit to one for that patient over the other. And so that's what I'm trying to get at, is there a benefit? And I'm trying to figure it out.
And this doctor says there is a benefit to using it with certain kinds of low-shedding cancers, such as melanoma and certain breast cancers. And this higher sensitivity is important, especially...
But the problem is he hasn't shown that there's a higher sensitivity. He just says there is one. How does he know? A random doctor doesn't know the level of sensitivity of a particular test unless he's hearing about it from someone or performing tests.
He explains the basis for his opinion, Your Honor, in the letter, which is that he uses these tests in his own practice with real patients and as a surgical oncologist.
Look, if he said, I use their test and it showed a no result, and then I used the other test and it showed a yes, and it turns out the answer was yes, so their test is clearly more sensitive than the other guy's test. He doesn't say anything like this. This is, okay, keep going.
So the second thing we cited is a presentation from a key opinion leader, and this is also on page 50, I believe, reporting positive results from using RaDaR for certain cancer patients while advising against using Signatera for them. This is at appendix 11692. And this is a presentation at a conference, I believe.
By whom? By the German breast group?
By Dr. Turner, who's... Yeah, Nicholas Turner on the first page, Your Honor, 11679.
Yeah. And 11692, I'm sorry, what did you want me to take away from this?
That this is a presentation by doctors who've used both tests, who are recommending using RaDaR because it's more sensitive than Signatera.
Where does it say, I'm sorry.
I'm at 11692, Your Honor.
11692, where does it say anything about RaDaR? I'm probably missing something.
The last bullet in the conclusions, Your Honor.
Although Signatera analysis has been approved by Medicare, use is not likely appropriate?
Yes.
I don't understand. How does that compare one
to the
other?
The whole thing is about using RaDaR, Your Honor. And then the point of it is that the study reported using positive results from our test and recommended for certain cancer patients and recommended against using their tests. And the point to your point about patient choice.
Where does it say, I'm missing this. I don't even see the word RaDaR on this slide. I don't see that it says.
It's not on this slide.
Does it say somewhere that Signatera is bad at this, but RaDaR is good at it? I mean, what? I'm all about patient choice. If it's going to make a difference, I mean, even just one person, you got me, but I'm not finding the evidence here of that.
So, Your Honor, the burden is on them to show that it won't make a difference. And the district court statement.
No, the burden's on them to show public interest. And public interest weighs heavily in favor of enforcement of intellectual property rights if all things are otherwise equal. Now, you have responded that things are not equal. Our test is better than theirs, and we have proof. And so I'm trying to find that proof.
Okay.
So I'm looking at, I guess, 11685, which at least has RaDaR up in the top. Not quite the heading, but the subheading. Can you explain what's going on here?
Sorry, what page are we on?
11685.
Yeah. So this is this explaining that the study was used during using RaDaR in the sentence that that Judge Stronto has pointed out, 11685.
But the conclusion that you pointed to, this bottom paragraph on 11692, how does that reflect, if it does, a comparison between the Signatera that's mentioned and the RaDaR that isn't?
Because this whole report, Your Honor, is the results of a study using RaDaR. That's the sentence that you pointed at.
Okay, I told you before I knew that there were two buckets for public interest. Do you want to move to the second bucket now, which is that bucket of clinical use for
yes,
study?
Yes, right. The research.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I meant, yeah,
and
for study.
I think it's significant 2 points. One is RaDaR has been on the market for clinical use since 2020, and they waited and this is a point that goes to both issues, they waited 7 months from the time their complaint was filed to sue on their patent. And this court has held that that is delay, that length of delay, 7 months.
So why isn't it relevant that they filed, I think, literally within a handful of days of the Medicare approval, which was going to make a difference in the effect on them from small and nothing to worry about to potentially big and something to worry about?
Because most of the harm that they point to, and also that the district court relied on, Your Honor, was about their supposed irreparable harm from partnerships that they had lost. Yet we'd been on the market since 2020 for clinical partnerships, and yet they didn't sue, and they didn't sue as soon as the patent issued, and they didn't even apply for this patent until after we announced our product. So they waited 7 months, which this court has held in Nutrition 21, and that it's undercuts your claim to irreparable harm, a 7 month delay from the time of patent issuance to complaint. They filed, and it's significant, I think, that they filed in Delaware against Inivata, which is a sub, on the basis of RADAR, did not assert, in December 2022, did not assert the 035 patent, even though it had already issued, and even though they've admitted in this lawsuit that they thought that RADAR infringed it as of the day that the patent issued, and they did not seek a preliminary injunction. Instead, they waited 7 months and filed suit in a different court in the District of North Carolina and sought this preliminary injunction. And so that delay is significant. And the fact that they're really trying to upset the status quo, the Fourth Circuit holds, it's a very high burden.
Wait, hold on now. I think the Fourth Circuit judge did an amazing job of ensuring they would not upset the status quo. Didn't she multiple times limit the scope of the injunction to ensure that anyone who was already employing or utilizing your test would be allowed to continue using it in all of the studies that they're doing?
The status quo, though, that's relevant to this question, Your Honor, is the pre-suit status quo. And the pre-suit status quo was that NeoGenomics had been on the market for research partnerships since 2020, including for future ones.
You've got to stop saying 2020. They didn't have a patent in 2020. Their patent issued long after that. So you got to stop saying 2020 as though you're trying to make it sound like they waited 4 years to sue you. They couldn't sue you. They didn't have a patent during a part of that.
They didn't even apply for the patent until after we announced our – I mean, they didn't apply for the patent until after we publicly announced our product, Your Honor. But they apply for this patent, but they still wait 7 months to sue, even though they've admitted in their interrogatory answers, which is in the JA, that they believe we – infringed on the day, and that 7 month delay severely undercuts their claim to irreparable harm. And Judge Toronto, to your question about the Medicare issue, no, both because of what I previously said, but also their own evidence shows that Medicare is not a driver of choice of tests. Like, so the Cowan report says it's like sixth on the choice and reason people choose things. So I think that timing is not meaningful. So to your point, Chief Judge Moore, about protecting patent rights, this court has held that there has to be a causal nexus between the supposed irreparable harm and the claim. But here, there's nothing in the claims that talks about there's nothing in the claims that goes to tumor informed. Yet the demand for our product is driven by its tumor-informed nature, and the things that we do to make it sensitive and tumor-informed is not related to the patented features. So we use...
Claimed invention is for cell-free DNA, though, right? So ctDNA is one type of cell-free DNA.
The parties have proceeded on the assumption that ctDNA falls within these claims. But yeah. The claims are just to processing cell-free DNA in no specific context. And they're not limited to tumor-informed. Yet the district court judge, the only harm it found was that we would be competing with them in the tumor-informed market and that we would be the only other competitor.
Why do you think that that matters? I mean, I take it you don't dispute that. I think you don't dispute. Tell me if you do. That without practice, assuming infringement,
which we don't, we also believe we don't infringe, but we haven't gotten to that.
Assuming infringement, they couldn't do the tumor informed one without infringing.
The district court didn't find that, Your Honor. The district court said, made a finding that that it appears we used their technology to come up with our test, but that's, they don't
even... not to generate the test, but it's just, again, a subset of the inputs into this sequence that is laid out in the claim.
Nope. So this court has held that just but-for causation, in the Apple v. Samsung case, a but-for causation is not enough. It has to be the a feature that drives demand for your product.
And right, so you had, I think, one sentence in your opposition to preliminary injunction on this, which cited one paragraph of SECRE, paragraph 88. I did not read that paragraph as saying that whatever this is was a driver of consumer demand, just a description of why SECRE thought you had certain qualities to your test.
Well, so
I don't think there's anything in there about consumer or anything.
Well, what it says is that there's just a minute. What it says is that the reason our product people purchase our product is because it's tumor informed.
I'm not sure
it does. Well, so it's their burden to show that their harm is tied to infringement. And they didn't separate out their claims to irreparable harm. The two patents were at issue in the district court, and they didn't separate them out. And so to the extent that the district court made an error in relying on the tumor-informed, sort of like should fall on them, not on us, because like it was their burden to show it. They didn't make a separate claim for the 035, a separate irreparable harm, showing like if you only find on the 035, then here's our irreparable harm. And the district court picked up on it's the tumor-informed piece of it that matters, but this patent doesn't, it's not a feature of this patent, tumor-informed. And so there's no causal nexus between what they've claimed in this patent, which is just basic DNA processing steps that aren't limited to any context.
Unless I'm wrong, your invention can't operate without performing the claimed steps here.
There's no finding to that effect, Your Honor.
Well, let's assume that's the case. I mean, let's assume that cell tumor or cancer ctDNA is a species of cell-free DNA. And if that's the case, then why isn't there a causal nexus?
Because there's no finding that there's no other way to do it, Your Honor. The district court focused purely on the harm to having a tumor-informed competitor, but this patent doesn't claim anything about tumor-informed.
But wouldn't it necessarily, if the claim is for a subset of DNA called cell-free DNA, and inside that subset of DNA there's a species of cell-free DNA known as ctDNA, and then it would be claimed, wouldn't it?
So not necessarily, and there's no finding to that effect. But even if that were true, this court has held, again, in the Apple v. Samsung cases, that but-for causation is not enough. So like just because like the battery in your laptop might infringe, the fact that, you know, that's not the reason the consumers buy it, and the laptop won't work if it doesn't have a battery, but that doesn't mean you can get an injunction.
Right. But I don't know if the facts here are the same as Apple Samsung, where in those cases we were looking at a patented component of some much larger complex device with thousands of components. And here we're talking about species of cell-free DNA, arguably, that is necessarily encompassed by the recited cell-free DNA in the claim. And so it doesn't quite match up. I mean, your reasoning might ultimately prevail that there's still some kind of nexus leap you have to make, but you can't just rely on the facts of Apple Samsung, I don't
think. Well, I think it's the same here. Natera has never contested that radar doesn't include many features beyond those that they claim infringe. And our evidence shows that we have special biometrics, special, you know, proprietary things that we do both before and after these allegedly infringing steps that are what make our test more sensitive and more desirable and is what drives demand for our test.
As much fun as this is, we are an hour in.
It's a citation question. So which paragraph of the Fluidigm application were you pointing to as significant?
I would point you to two paragraphs, Judge Toronto, in volume 3, paragraph 122 on A13097. A13097-122. That's the any fluid in blood. And A13103, paragraph 176, that shows that it can be used for diagnosing cancer.
Okay.
176. Okay.
Let's hear from opposing counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, and may it please the Court. The District Court committed no error, and certainly no clear error, in finding that Natera had established a likelihood of success on the merits, and that NeoGenomics' obviousness case was not sufficiently substantial to undermine that substantial likelihood.
As far as you know, we haven't given any helpful clarification to what this substantial question standard means. Is that right?
Well, there's a case called Titan Tire. Well, I think both eBay and Titan Tire tell you what that substantial question means. eBay says that our burden is to show a likelihood of success on the merits. And so something is not a sufficiently substantial question unless it shows that we don't have a likelihood of success on the merits. And Titan Tire walks through, and it's actually 566 at 1379, walks through the burden of what it means to establish or disprove a substantial question.
Right,
and it explains in the end that you show, convince the court that more likely than not, you will be able to prove at trial by clear and convincing evidence that the patent is invalid. And so substantial question is substantial enough to defeat the likelihood of success on the merits. And that was not found here. And they actually agreed on that below.
Amazon.com, though, says vulnerability is really the name of the game. And so what we have are different expressions that don't really line up with each other very well.
Right.
Judge Toronto's question, I think, is fair, is how do we really quantify a substantial question? I mean, there's, in re-exam practice, substantial new question of patentability. And substantial new question of patentability is something I think everyone agrees is less than preponderance of evidence of some asserted fact to be true.
Yeah, Titan Tire walks through that and says, for example, substantial evidence is a very low standard, and that's what we don't mean as substantial here. But you couldn't look at substantial question of patentability and mean it's less than something that combination with other things or on its own makes it unlikely that you'll prevail at trial, because otherwise you'd have to be overturning eBay. eBay makes clear that what is the standard? Likelihood of success on the merits. What does the other side show? They show that you're not likely to succeed on the merits. And so a substantial question has to be substantial enough that we're not likely to prevail. And I think in the district court, NeoGenomics counsel agreed. If you turn to page 20269 of the record, they're discussing that substantial question standard. And the district court asks, so I would not say the patent's invalid. I would say they have not shown a likelihood of success on validity. Answer, that's what you would show, right? Not a substantial likelihood of success on the merits. There's not a substantial question doctrine that departs what eBay standard is. It's an iteration of eBay that says it's got to be substantial enough that in combination or alone, it means you're not likely to prevail. But here, turning to merits, though, obviousness requires motivation to combine. Motivation to combine to achieve the claimed invention. And below, what they relied on was CAPR. CAPR, which is tumor tissue, whole tumor tissue, essentially pure cancer, not SNPs, not these little tiny single nucleotide variations. And so what they have to show is that you have a multiplex amplification, so you have 25 to 2,000 SNPs in a single reaction volume, so in this volume, and they combine that with circulating tumor DNA, ctDNA, which is, this needle in a haystack.
Isn't it true that the entire debate came down to motivation to run cfDNA through this already existing device with a reasonable expectation of success?
No, because I think that the already existing, the Fluidigm access array that you're talking about, the initial part, I didn't understand, except for the paragraph in their opening brief, that Fluidigm access array
occupies that the district court relied on, right?
So the
district court said, I conclude that, this would be a very, very difficult thing and very unpredictable thing, and it would have to be would necessarily need to be done with precision, and I'm not convinced that skilled artisan would believe that it could be done with reasonable precision, and that's why I am not concluding there's a validity issue.
And there's three pieces to that that are really important. One is the nature of circulating tumor DNA. That it's extraordinarily dilute. And it's not just extraordinarily dilute. It's in the sea of cfDNA. So you can have a tiny cancer tumor so small that you're not going to detect an image.
The claim is for cfDNA, not ctDNA.
Now it says associated with cancer, the last two words of the claim. Associated with cancer. No one really disputed that this was about circulating tumor DNA, because CAPR, their prior art reference, was about tumor DNA, not some cell-free DNA that's not tumor DNA. So it makes it move over to that. And it wasn't, I don't think it's been disputed throughout.
That comes from those last three words.
Yeah, associated with cancer. And then at page 21322, the district court is explaining her decision. And she says she distinguishes statements about cell-free DNA because, quote, these statements were not discussing circulating tumor DNA. And circulating tumor DNA is distinct because you might have this little tiny tumor and it's going to be shedding some DNA, but the rest of your entire body is shedding cell-free DNA. So it's the sea of cfDNA and you're looking for that ctDNA. You're looking for that needle in a haystack. So then on top of that.
So what was missing from either the specifically cited or displayed evidence for which includes some, you know, concession type evidence from mm-hmm. Dr. Metzger in the IPR, and I guess in the CareDx 101, although that wasn't.
And so what's always missing,
Judge, always missing.
Yeah, what's always missing, Judge Toronto, is to take the things that aren't disclosed in that concession or in that, and then to motivate to combine them with what is disclosed in view of their utter incompatibilities. And I want to talk about that utter incompatibility, because when you have this ctDNA, this needle in a haystack, circulating tumor DNA, you have a huge problem if you try and do what we call multiplex amplification, more than 25 to 2,000 SNP loci in a single reaction volume. You're not breaking it up with little pools like split and pool. You're going to do it all together.
Just to be clear, each of the 48 wells in the Fluidigm device is a multi-item reaction chamber.
Right. So
those are not one SNP per.
So, yeah, CAPR discloses that you can use 10 in a single well.
Okay.
But 10 was sort of the outer limit, and we'll explain that sort of, maybe I should just go to our papers. If you turn to page column 85, line 5, it says, and that's
of
page,
your, of your
appendix 162.
Of your patent.
Of our patent. It says, currently performing multiplex PCR reactions of more than 5 to 10 targets presents a major challenge and is often hindered by primer side products, such as primer dimers and other
columns.
Okay,
column and line number?
So that's column 85, line 5. And then in lines, so the problem is you create all this junk. And our expert testified about what happens is when you have too many of these different things in a single reaction volume, too many primers, too many targets, you end up getting junk. You get nonspecific products, spurious products, patent ones probably called the mischief products, junk. And if you look at the transcript, you get all this junk.
So
and then
the
it goes
bottom,
on to
the
say,
bottom of this paragraph, In column 85, it says methods described in the prior art used to multiplex more than 50 or 100 reactions in one reaction volume.
Right, but at that point, he's not talking about the issue of ctDNA. He's talking, which is the smaller and harder to deal with. He's talking about things like what CAPR has. You've got whole tumor. You've got these very large pieces, which are easy to do. But when he talks about multiplex PCR at the top, right in, I guess it's right before, he's talking about it's particularly useful for small volume, when you have small amounts of DNA. And then he goes on and he says, okay, you've got the primer dimers and other artifacts. And then from lines 8 to 11, he says, well, that's okay with some things, some types of detection, typically probes is what he's talking about. And then he continues, lines 11 to 14. But when using sequencing as a method of detection, the vast majority of sequencing reads would sequence such artifacts and not the desired sequences. So when you combine up, you have a needle in a haystack, CT and DNA flooded in a sea of cfDNA.
Okay,
and then you
want
to do multiplex amplification.
Stop.
You get the junk.
Stop.
Okay.
Page 9 and 10 of the district court's opinion is right. Where, it's very cursory, the analysis on this point with regard to obviousness. And I'm struggling a little bit to read into the paragraph starting on 9 and spanning 10, this argument you're making about ctDNA. So try to explain to me how what you're saying now is in fact what the district court found in this paragraph.
So there's, I think there's two places you'll look, Your Honor. First is, in addition to that, she went back at, I think it was page 21322, where she goes back and says, no, no, not just cfDNA, ctDNA.
Wait, are you,
and
in those parentheticals, page of her opinion. I've got her opinion.
So on 9 to 10, she's saying, she's saying circulating tumor DNA is just a subset of cfDNA. It's in lower yields. So it's this needle in a haystack, right? And then she talks about the challenges, the next one is cfDNAs and others, presented obstacles to successfully amplifying and sequencing ctDNA with precision.
I can't
during the
follow you. You're going too fast.
Oh, I'm sorry. Page 10, top of the page. These challenges associated with cfDNA and others presented obstacles to successfully amplifying and sequencing ctDNA with precision during the relevant period.
Right, so what I understand that to mean is the problems that she's observed with cell-free DNA create problems using cell tumor DNA.
That's
that what CT stands for, cell tumor?
And circulating tumor.
Circulating tumor DNA.
All right, and the reason for that is, and when she says with precision, she's talking about the testimony from our expert, and he was testified live at the hearing and was subject to cross-examination about what happens when you try and do too much amplification of too many products in one volume at a time. You get the junk, the primer dimers, the nonspecific products, these things that interfere with sequencing.
Well, she didn't cite that, did she?
No, she didn't, but she just needs evidence in the record.
So she used the word precision, and now you're telling me I should assume that because she used the word precision that was her making a finding based on something your expert said that she didn't cite, and it's probably buried in 15 volumes of stuff?
Well, actually, if you...
Don't do the needle in the haystack thing to me.
It's not a needle in the haystack, Your Honor, because I would encourage the court just to sit down and read his testimony at the hearing, because his testimony was all about junk, getting too much junk if you try and amplify too many things in a single reaction volume.
Did she cite his testimony anywhere in this obviously?
No, because she said that she was going to point to the written testimony as opposed to the oral testimony.
But she seems to be relying on Volek, and Volek is really just talking about cell-free DNA and how there are formidable challenges with cell-free DNA.
And those format, when you have even more dilute, and that's, circulating tumor DNA, those challenges become multiplied manyfold. And so that, I think, is why that's a huge difference. And the patent it's here is about...
Why didn't, you know, the question I have in my mind is why didn't the district court even address the evidence that the other side did present? Like, for example, the Lowe reference or the Cantor reference. I mean, doesn't Cantor even talk specifically about cancer cells?
Yeah, but those actually...
You know, here at Cantor, the invention is... This is at JA13150, paragraph 15. The invention is also useful in detection of tumor-derived DNA mutations isolated from cells in the plasma of a cancer patient and detecting donor-derived DNA in the plasma of a transplant recipient.
Right.
This seems to be talking about, you know, and then... At JA13156 is also talking about circulating tumor-specific nucleic acids in a blood, urine, or stool sample.
Right. And those would be cited because the problem, and what our expert testified about, was that...
Right now I'm just trying to figure out why didn't the district court address some
because
of these things.
Right.
That Van Ness did cite to and even quote things from Cantor, things from Lowe,
I think it's because they're not relevant to the combination that you have to have here because you can't combine those because I'm not talking about that multiplex amplification that creates all the junk. And what I point the court to is where our expert testifies, and this is Appendix 20183, and he explains, performing multiplex PCR, and he's talking about you've got your 25 to 2,000 SNPs in a single reaction volume. It's all there. Created a lot of, I'll just call it junk, things you would not want to amplify. And then he describes why that interferes with sequencing. He says, when I scoop in, so you're taking all this amplified product and scooping it in, chances are I'll get some wild type, but I'll also get some junk. And if I take a bigger scoop, I may not even get the molecule I'm interested in, the ctDNA, because I'm just sequencing more junk. And this was known in the art. This is the testimony that the district court heard and the district court understood. And our patent also explains that that's true, because it says, for example, column 47, lines 38 to 49, is talking about artifacts, primer dimers, things that interfere with detecting the targeted amplicons.
We're going to limit the other side to only the pieces of evidence that they presented to the district court for purposes of this PI motion. I think we would have to do the same thing for your side and limit ourselves to the things that were actually briefed and that the district court ended up relying on.
I think that's entirely fair. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. But our goose testified at the hearing, and he specified that you get this junk, and that junk interferes with sequencing. And that's backed up by the very thing that the court had before, which is the trial.
She didn't rely on that. She didn't rely on that.
Yeah, and she also has a footnote that says, the fact that I didn't cite everything or all the evidence doesn't mean I didn't consider it all.
Well, yes, but there's a difference between considering it and relying on it.
Well,
I consider a lot of things.
Yeah,
I rely on very few.
The court pointed out that it's really difficult. You can't just take CAPR, which was about whole tumor DNA, and not even about SNPs, a single nucleotide pair that's wrong, and it's just translate that right over to this multiplex amplification of SNPs in a single reaction volume and have it usable for sequencing. Instead, she said, look, it was known in the art that there were obstacles to doing this because of the nature of CF and in particular ctDNA. And they haven't shown motivation to combine because they haven't shown how anything in the prior art overcomes that.
Well,
and
your own Metzger's declaration from Illumina, the Illumina IPR, was in fact discussed at the hearing, right?
That's right. And ordinarily,
paragraph 116, at A20264, was the other side's attorney walked through paragraph 116 of the Metzger Declaration where Ms. Maynard was showing us all the content that, one of ordinary skill in the art would have expected success in being able to sequence cell-free DNA found in maternal blood. It was further well known by 2008 that one could isolate, amplify, and sequence cell-free genomic DNA. These are Dr. Metzger's words that were quoted and presented at the hearing, I believe it's an evidentiary hearing, to the court, and we don't really have a response at A9, A10 from the district court on this.
Yeah, so I think in each instance when they point and say, this is what Dr. Metzger said, or this is what Fluidigm says, the question you have to ask is, okay, what's the motivation to combine that with what's left out? And so what you read there omits one important thing. First, we're not talking about SNPs, and we're not talking about this multiplex amplification in a single reaction volume of something that has that
SNPs. And everything you're saying right now is sort of like the next level question of drilling down to that next layer and then figuring out those sorts of details. But that's not the level that the district court was playing with. She was playing at this more broader fundamental question of, do you do cell-free DNA or cell-T DNA through one of these access array things of Fluidigm's? No, you just don't. And I'm going to cite the patent owner's evidence, and I'm not going to cite or discuss or address anything that the defendant brought up on this score, including Dr. Metzger's own words.
Yeah, and under a clear error and abuse of discretion standard, taking what was submitted, the district court did a fine job in pointing out that there's a difference between what CAPR was, and that's their reference, CAPR, and what they're promoting. And what they needed to show was a motivation to combine. And so what's missing from Metzger as well is, look, Metzger actually, the Illumina declaration, Metzger actually went back and explained why the Illumina fluid access array or anything like it would teach against, because it doesn't teach away from doing what the patent says. Because although it has a preamplification step where you have lots of things in a single reaction volume, it then recognizes that that's a real problem because you get all the junk. And so then it goes on and it does what's called a split and pool. It just does single
junk. Lost. When you say it goes on, what are you, I'm going to talk
about the Fluidigm access array that he's relying on at that point. And that you have to go back and do singleton replication. And so if it says 9,216, you end up with 9,216 individual aliquots, individual reaction chambers, and you have to do one or maybe potentially 10 if you're doing something else, each SNP in each of those different chambers. That's the old split and pool method that isn't very accurate. It's the old split and pool method that's very intensive. It's the old art. And that teaches away from what we came up with, which is using that single reaction volume, because they have to do two steps. They need that two steps.
Each individual well in a split and pool can't be each individual well in a split and pool can't be considered a single reaction volume?
Each individual well might, but you would have to have 25 to 2,000 SNP loci being tested for in each individual well in order to meet our claims. And in those wells, in some instances they say one, and in other instances it's up to 10, which is consistent with our patent, which said beyond 5 to 10, it really is a problem. And so that's why they have to go back to split and pool, precisely because the prior art recognized that a single reaction volume, especially when you're dealing with something rare like ctDNA, is really problematic.
And again, this is not anything we can find the district court saying. This is...
Well, the district court cited more generally the difficulty of transiting CAPR, which was entire tumor tissue, not even SNPs, over to this very different method of multiplex amplification, single reaction volume, and for SNPs and for ctDNA, which is like that needle in a haystack.
Hey, can I ask you, the Fluidigm patent application, which we were discussing in the first half of the argument, does that involve split and pool, or
yes, it's
only split and pool?
It has a two-step, it discloses two steps, one of which is that you can put things in a single reaction volume, but then it follows and it requires you to go on, follow on and do a split and pool because you end up with all of that junk. So you have to do that split and pool. And so in that sense, it teaches away from what we are teaching,
Is that different from CAPR?
Pardon?
Is that different from CAPR?
It's not that different from CAPR, no. Because CAPR was using split and pool. The difference is it was using the Fluidigm access array. But the difference is that CAPR was just whole cell tumor DNA, these longer strips, like not cell-free DNA, which are little tiny pieces, and not SNPs, not single nucleotide variants, and even Fluidigm.
So just on that point, in the Fluidigm patent application, paragraph 175, it says these methods are applicable to identifying the presence of particular polymorphisms such as SNPs. Now, that happens to be the paragraph that, unless I've misunderstood something, is the sole paragraph cited in paragraph 116 of Metzger's IPR declaration, which I think was his exhibit 1003, citing paragraph 175.
Right.
It does
mention that it's applicable to SNPs. That's correct. But when it goes through and it's talking about cell-free DNA, this is sort of just it doesn't go and say, this has been proved, this has been, you know, this will work. You can do this with sequencing. It doesn't say any of those things. And as a matter of fact, I think if you were to look at Fluidigm paragraph 120, when it talks about the split and pool, and it's listing the suitable detection methods, so paragraph 120 is 13097. And we're a little bit in the weeds here, but it's on the bottom of that page. And it says, the resulting 9,216 reaction chambers, so we're back to split and pool, we've got these 9,216, can then be subject to amplification, followed by detection of amplification products, which can be carried out by any suitable means. And then they list these means. But those are not means such as using a massively parallel sequencer. They're back to the probe methods that the patent explained aren't subject to problems when you have junk product, when you have dimers and other things in there. They're the things that don't matter. But if you're going to add what we have, which is massively parallel sequencing, you're going to need to get around that junk. And that's what the patent explains in place after place, is that you need, if you're going to do this this multiplex amplification, 25 to 2,000 SNP in a single reaction volume, you're going to have dimers, you're going to have mischief products, and you're going to have to figure out a way to get around it. So the last thing I'll just point to in the patent, and I think this is pretty important, is that it says that the high level of multiplexing with minimal non-target amplification, I'm sorry, that's page, column 47, what, appendix 143, column 47, and it's about line 46 to 49, and it says the high level of multiplexing with minimal non-target amplicons that has now been achieved, that means through the patent, through the specification, what it teaches, allows PCR followed by sequencing to be used as an alternative to microarrays. So where that third piece, massively parallel sequencing, is a critical element of this, and it's because it doesn't work well. It doesn't work at all if you have all what the what Dr. Metzger called junk.
It's basically your argument that the prior art taught away because it all looked at the split and pool method, whereas you are focused on the single reaction volume.
That's part of it. And the last thing I'd point out is that, you know, look, CareDx, which Metzger was talking about at the time, wasn't about SNPs associated with cancer. It was about aneuploidy. I'm not sure I'm saying it correctly, but that's a condition where an entire chromosome is missing. So you're looking for a big chunk and a big chunk being missing. And that's a very different issue than when you're looking at something that's very tiny.
Could you tell me why you waited 7 months to sue?
So we were already engaged in litigation, and we had against others. And so at the time, it seemed like going after one person at a time was an appropriate way of doing it. And the district court found, and this was an abuse of discretion standard.
There's only two of you in this market with this kind of product, correct?
Now, yes. At the time, no. We had a lawsuit against a company called ArcherDX at the time. And ArcherDX, we won that case, got an injunction. And so they are no longer considered a significant player. So I think at the time we were engaged in litigation, and the district court made a specific finding on page, I think it's 19 of the appendix, that it's okay because we are engaged in litigation. And what made us come forward and actually go in and seek that injunction, sue and almost immediately seek an injunction, is when that irreparable harm became apparent and obvious. We weren't going to bother the court. We weren't going to run
it. When did it become apparent and obvious? After 4 days after Medicare had announced?
Exactly.
That's the problem. That's not your irreparable harm. If that was your irreparable harm, that would be different. The district court found your irreparable harm is all tied to the clinical studies on your product. It didn't tie it to patient use.
Not
to the clinical studies.
Not at all, because the district court found, and starting with, there's a huge public interest in ensuring that we protect patents. But I think our irreparable harm is tied to both.
We're not talking about public interest. Yes. We're talking about irreparable harm, so stay on topic.
Yes. So the district court starts out with a nascent market. So this is a relatively new market. And she talks about there being a first mover advantage, a loss of first mover advantage, and that's at Appendix 15. And you lose.
But individual patient use isn't what the irreparable harm section is all about. And she didn't find that. Your first mover advantage, she ties it all to clinical trials and clinical validation, which will then improve your marketability.
Chief Judge Moore, I disagree with you on that.
Show me where she said something different.
Okay, so if we go to, I need my copy of the opening brief. All right, I'll just go to volume one. We'll do that. So if you go to the about that piece. She talks about a likelihood of irreparable harm, and that when you have to compete against products that incorporate and infringe your own patents, you have irreparable harm. That includes competing for doctor use. Then she talks about evidence of head-to-head competition, lost market share. When you're talking about clinical trials, that's not market share. Lost sales. You're not talking about lost sales when you're doing it.
With all due respect, every single doctor market, that can all be compensated for. That's not irreparable harm that can't be compensated for with a bond that they could easily post. What's the true irreparable harm?
I think the true irreparable harm is, first, when you have a nascent market, right, you're taking the market's taking off. When somebody else takes your invention, takes your innovation, you lose your reputation in terms of being the innovator, your name recognition, your customer relationships.
Where does she say that?
Talks about page 15. Natera has a first mover advantage. This advantage includes a period of exclusivity in which you can establish brand recognition, customer loyalty, and business foundations. This is where she's talking about that, and she cites Douglas Dynamics. And Douglas Dynamics was a case in which someone copied patent snowplow features. And this court upheld an injunction, even though they weren't losing sales, because the court points out that, look, when someone comes into the market and has your innovation and sells it as their own, that takes you down and tells them that you're not really an innovator. You're just another one, somebody on the market. Look, we know Bayer aspirin because Bayer came out with it first, and the word aspirin got genericized as a result. Signatera was the first on the market, and it was and the curve in terms of acceptance. We pointed out that we invested hundreds of millions of dollars in establishing the market, overcoming doctor resistance, oncologist resistance to this. And that, you are irreparably harmed when someone else jumps in and says, okay, we have the same exact thing too. And on top of that, we point out that that injury is exacerbated when a copyist touts its product as superior. And not just because they're denigrating you. If that product does not meet expectations, that harms the entire market. That engenders distrust of the entire product market. And then finally, there's stickiness, and the court does mention stickiness. And stickiness isn't just a matter of clinical trials, because stickiness is, for example, when a patient starts using one of these, you pretty much have to stay with it for 5 years because you're working from a baseline. And you can't go back up and redo it from a baseline, which is why all of the patient uses have been grandfathered. We have a two-player market, which also shows irreparable harm, because we would be the sole person, the sole one in the market with irreparable harm. And look, there's simply no clear error here in showing that there's irreparable harm to us in the market. When you lose your reputation, when you lose your brand recognition, when you lose your first mover advantage, that's not something that's easily
about causal nexus.
Sure.
After reading our case law, I'm a little confused how to think about causal nexus.
Yeah, so
in the context of this case.
I think in this case it's a little confusing, but the primary reason that it's confusing in this case is waiver.
Is what?
Waiver. The opening, the brief below that NeoGenomics submitted devoted exactly three sentences to causal nexus. The first one says there's no causal nexus. The second is a point they're no longer pursuing. And here's the third one. There is insufficient nexus because RaDaR sales are driven by the sensitivity that comes from RaDaR's 48 tumor-specific variants in advanced bioinformatics, not Natera's products. That's the whole of the argument. Now the argument is, well, you can't look at the tumor-informed market because that's not in the patent. Now, set aside the fact that the patent talks about SNPs associated with cancer. Setting that aside, that's not going to put the judge on notice that we're arguing about which part of the market you should be looking at. And it's especially true because at the time this was being litigated, there were two patents at issue, the 454 and the 035. The 454, the district court didn't rely on. The 454 was specific to the tumor-informed market. So when they say, this argument, which applies to both Natera's patents, plural, district court is going to look at that and say, this means that I can't look at the tumor-informed market because they've combined the two patents together. Obviously, you can look at the tumor-informed market because at least one of the patents is tumor-informed. So the district court just wasn't on notice that somehow she was supposed to say, gee, I should be talking only about the tumor-naive market or the tumor-informed market. It's just as waived can be. But it's also just without merit, Your Honor. It certainly doesn't show an abuse of discretion or some sort of clear error because NeoGenomics is relying on supposed sensitivity, right? But that sensitivity comes from using our patented technology, from infringing our patent. So
that's not what they say. They say it comes from their algorithm, which is different from yours.
They do, but you wouldn't have any sensitivity unless you could actually do what we're doing. If you couldn't have that sensitivity, well, first of all, the algorithms, there's absolutely no record on their bioinformatics. They just say bioinformatics. Nothing else, no record on it. But even setting that aside, you don't have the requisite sensitivity unless you're doing what we claimed, or you're within the claims, where you're doing a single reaction volume with 25 to 2,000 SNP loci. Because that single reaction volume, and I'm quoting from the patent, appendix 143, column 47, lines 24 to 48, is what reduces variability that can occur between reactions and corrects for amplification bias in the prior art, which is what establishes sensitivity. If you have to go back to the old split and pool, then you're going to have all the problems in the split and pool, which undermine the sensitivity.
Are you saying the claims of the 035 patent are directed to tumor-informed testing?
Are they directed to tumor-informed testing?
You said associated with cancer. So what is it you want me to understand from that? Am I supposed to understand that the claims of the 035 patent are limited to tumor-informed testing?
I don't think the court... I think that's an interesting claim construction issue, but I don't think the patents are necessarily limited to tumor-informed testing, but they are about SNPs associated with cancer. And so we're talking about detection of cancer, and then when they start with CAPR and say CAPR is our starting point, CAPR is about tumor tissue. And so when you're trying to extend CAPR to something else, to extend CAPR out, you're extending it to cfDNA, which is tumor tissue, or otherwise circulating tumor DNA. This is clearly what the case is really about in terms of the fight. It's circulating tumor DNA. We're both in the same market.
But on page 17, under the causal nexus analysis, the district court seems to be focusing exclusively on the tumor-informed testing.
That's right. And the district court...
So if you're telling me the 035 is not limited to tumor-informed testing, how do you meet the causal nexus requirement?
Because even for tumor-informed, you're not going to get anywhere. You're not going to have a sufficient sensitive product. You're not going to have a product that really even works at all unless you are infringing our patent.
And why is that different from, the battery in the iPhone without which none of the rest works?
I do think it's different in the following sense. And that is what makes it work and what they claim as their differentiator is sensitivity. And what gets you out from being not sufficiently sensitive, the problems with split and pool where you might not have any ctDNA in some of the wells, and therefore you're going to end up with, or you won't have the right ctDNA that the primers are supposed to be associated with in any of the wells. You end up with something that's much more reliable, and that reliability is a necessary part of what you need for this market. And that's true of tumor-informed and not tumor-informed. And so I think that is all on all fours with what this patent's about. It's like, before you did it, if you don't use our patent, you get too much junk and it's not going to work. And if you use our patented techniques, then you get rid of that junk and you can do massive parallel sequencing. You can be more cost effective as a result because you don't have to use probe. It gets around all the problems.
The district court didn't say any of that.
Sorry?
The district court didn't say any of that.
No, the district court was very focused on the tumor-informed market, and the district court didn't say any of that for a specific reason, because there was no argument below that it was improper to look at the tumor-informed market. There was those three sentences I spoke about, and there's nothing in those three sentences that say judge for
the
035.
Well, that's because there was originally a motion on both the 454 and the 035, right? Isn't that the reason why?
Yes.
The district court never addressed 454 because she addressed 035 instead. And I think that she got confused and thought 035 was also limited to the tumor-informed market.
I don't think so, because if there's a difference between the two patents and a difference in the sort of remedy that you should have, the burden of the person who's seeking that is to say you need to limit your remedy or the remedy is not linked. For the 035, here's one problem. For the 454, here's another problem. But the only argument that was made, three sentences, Your Honor, three sentences, was that, oh, we have better...
Who sought the injunction?
Pardon?
Who sought the injunction?
We sought the injunction.
So you had the burden.
We had the burden, but not that, if I'm understanding correctly, we had the burden to show causation, and we show that we are suffering all these harms, both in all markets, because...
Don't you also have the burden to show causal nexus?
I think that's probably right. We had to show a causal nexus, but I think there is a causal nexus, because they couldn't be in the tumor-informed market in the way they are without using our patent invention. And it's not that it's a small piece of it. It's everything. It is basically what drives demand is that sensitivity according to them themselves. And that sensitivity means they couldn't compete without it. And if the sensitivity is what's important and they cite sensitivity in their affidavit, what's make it different, then they need to get away from split and pool and go to single reaction volume to have that sensitivity.
Our patent. So I'm just thinking about the battery example.
Right.
Perhaps your reference to, alternatives might translate into the point that I might have a patent on a particular way of doing a battery, but there are lots of other ways to do a battery, and if you use one of the, by assumption, dumber ways to have a battery, then you get all the other benefits and everybody will still buy the iPhone. And that's not true here, right?
I think that's exactly
right.
That's
the difference.
It's not a question between a smarter and a dumber. It's a question between one that works and one that doesn't. One that gets around the problems of split and pool and one that incorporates the problems of split and pool. And I think maybe perhaps I should talk just for a little bit about the public interest, Judge Moore, Chief Judge Moore, or unless the court has
no. No, talk about public interest, but skip over how important patents are. We all know that. Go straight to whether or not.
But that's what I have written down at the top, Judge Moore.
That's irrelevant to me. Start with what are people going to be harmed by not having access to their test?
And the answer is absolutely not. And I go to point to just page 20 of the court's opinion, appendix 20, and it says, Signatera is clinically validated for use with the same cancers as radar. No clear error in that. In fact, it's actually clinically validated for 8 more, and I just went to the court to a comparison, 24486, paragraph 44, with 11271, paragraph 15, and 2447, paragraphs 46 to 48.
I don't know you think I got from that.
Because I assume the clerks would get it, but it's not sort of a comparison of what the validations are. And if you look at the validations, you realize that our coverage is broad and theirs is narrow. And I think their Dr. Sikri pointed that out.
I'm sorry, is everything that's in their coverage also covered by you?
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. The court found, and there's no clear error.
What about the blood cancers?
So they don't have clinical validation for the blood cancers, and there's no reason to believe. It's just completely unsupported, and there's no reason to believe that they would get that clinical validation ahead of us. But if something comes up, right, if it turns out that there is a validation that they have and we don't, and that there may be harm, that's what a Rule 60 motion is for.
Okay, do me a favor. My clerk said that I may have talked over you, and when she needs to go back, if she needs to, and find those page numbers, because she spent all weekend, you know, basically trying to create this from scratch. Go ahead and blabber out your page numbers again, where you can find the list of different.
I apologize for blabbering. It's also the validations. Our validations are actually on our website. If you want to do it, but I hate to go outside the
record. I'm not going
to
your website.
Yeah. Okay. It's 2446, paragraph 44. 11271, paragraph 15. 2447, paragraphs 46 to 48. And that's how you do your comparison, and it shows that we have 8 more. And the district court just committed no clear error in finding that
why is it right to limit the inquiry to what's validated as opposed to, for example, what this doctor in Texas says as a, you know, anecdotal, I don't mean to be disparaging with that word, but with, you know, what's frequently now described as the opposite of evidence-based medicine, but, you know, you can have important stuff going on before there is empirical validation.
If you're talking about just sort of off-market,
group sense.
I think it's in terms of promoting it, in terms of the general use, what you want is, and what Medicare will pay for, and what the insurers will pay for, and what you really should be doing as a physician, you're going to wait for clinical validation. And both of us are working to get that clinical validation.
Okay, but that's a little bit crazy. If I had cancer, I'd go off-label in 10 seconds, and so would you. Yeah. If you had any reason to think it could be beneficial, you'd pay out of pocket and you'd go off label.
And then even that, there's simply no basis. And the district court found that that's disputed and not at all clear that radar has better sensitivity for any particular indication. And again, if there's something that's different.
What do you mean? We've got the testimony, I don't remember his name, I can find it in a second, of their executive that claims that theirs is an order of magnitude more sensitive than yours.
Right. And so, I should explain. So first, there's no head-to-head studies. But that's not the big deal. And there's no expert who opined. Again, it's just a corporate executive. But that's not the big deal. What the big deal is
when you say there's no expert, it's the corporate executive. This is a doctor and a researcher and a scientist with 20 years of oncology research experience. Don't refer to him simply as a corporate executive and blow it off as though we haven't read the record and you're going to fool me into thinking he's an accountant.
So let me tell you what the difference is then. And I apologize if you feel like I'm belittling him. What matters to patients is how often, how reliably it detects cancer when cancer is present. And when it comes to that, the record shows that Signatera blows radar away. If you look at page 7932 of the appendix, that's our one Moshkevitz's declaration. It's 93% and 100% for Signatera versus 62% and 64% for the new genomics product. And what they're touting when they say greater sensitivity is actually something quite different from
it. I'm sorry, I didn't understand that. I understand the numbers 90 and 60, but what are they percents of?
So that's the clinical test of like when there's actually a tumor present. does the assay actually pick it up and say, yes, you have the tumor, as opposed to missing it. And then what they tell is something actually a little different, which is called limits of detection. It's not the clinical measure of how accurate are you? Are you doing a good job with patients? Which is sort of a measure of how low, how dilute the ctDNA theoretically could be and still get picked up in the test. But when, even on that, what they're presenting to the court and what they presented below isn't at all persuasive. For example, Dr. Sikri's declaration says, oh, there's 12 studies. Well, the first 7 studies actually don't mention RaDaR. I don't know what they're for. And the difference they're talking about tends to be analytical, which means that you use contrived DNA and you say, well, contrived DNA, here's what you get in terms of it. But when you actually try and translate that to actual clinical results with real patients, the advantage goes away. And that's Appendix 7932, which is the Russell study. So they had relied on something called FLAC, which was analytical, sort of contrived DNA. But when you went to actual patients, that completely disappeared. And finally, there's a paragraph on the reply in 32, which does shows kind of the bad math, apples to oranges comparisons that are going on here. And it looks at something, a Coakley article, which wasn't relied on below because it's new. And it does a comparison that wasn't pointed out to the district court, which is to our supposed theoretical.
Can you go to page 11287 of the appendix, please? It's in volume 2.
11287.
Yeah. This is the Sikri testimony. Paragraph 44.
Yep.
So how do you respond to this? Because this suggests that their test is an order of magnitude more sensitive than your test.
Right. And Your Honor, that's potentially good marketing, but it is not good science or good patient care. Because when you're talking about sensitivity, what you really care about is does it detect it when it's there with the patients? And what I was explaining is if you're looking at something, and I think this all stems from that original FLAC study, if you're looking at just contrived DNA in an analytical study, which isn't actual patient data, that doesn't mean you're going to get better results for actual patients. And there was a later study afterwards, it's called Russell 7932, that showed that you didn't have an advantage in it. And if I go to the page 32 of the reply, the Coakley article, which they recite, it kind of points out the nature of the errors we're looking at here. Because they cite Coakley as saying our sensitivity, and this is limits of detection. How low can you go? It's not actually detecting cancer. It's there. It's the theoretical limit of how little ctDNA can be there before you pick it up. And they say that they could go down to 0.0011%, which is smaller. But if you look at Coakley, page 901, they don't have a pin site, but you look at page 911, it says 0.011%. Which is actually worse than the 0.01% they attribute to us. And then when they compare us to Coakley, they're looking at a 2017 source showing our supposed limits of detection, not anything that's current. And so this is the kind of sort of bad mathematics, apples to oranges that the district court was presented with. And the district court didn't have to be persuaded when it came to clinical validation, we were validated for everything that they were. When it came to, what was the actual results for cancer patients?
So, let me just understand. What is your response to why their claim in this report that based on this study that was done, they were an order of magnitude more sensitive in detecting the ctDNA?
Yeah. Okay, so this actually isn't a head-to-head study. It's not the same study for the same two products. It's one study where they say we got 0.001, and another one saying that ours got 0.01 VAF. And then therefore, based on these two different studies, they do a comparison and say theirs is more accurate.
Well, I think that at some point I remember them saying your 0.01 VAF came from your own literature. Is that right? Does that sound
That's accurate? Correct. But remember, you'd have to use the same techniques. You'd have to use, for example, the same blood samples. They use a lot more blood sample than we do. There's lots of differences that make these not comparable. But what really matters is clinical. What's happening with the patients? Not these analytical questions of, gee, how low could you go with this contrived DNA? And when it came to that, The district court was presented with evidence and committed no clear error and no abuse of discretion in finding that there isn't a difference. There isn't, that when you compare it actually from 7932, Signatera is far better. And again, 7932, we explained that when they actually went to clinical data, any advantage disappeared. Analytical studies saying, gee, looks at the limits of detection as opposed to actually detecting in patients simply cannot make that difference. And certainly the district court didn't commit abuse of discretion or clear error on this topic. This is why we have hearings. This is why we have experts. This is why we have testimony. And this is why we have district courts.
Did the district court say any of what you just said?
So the district court said, and I'll quote, that it was disputed and not at all clear that radar achieves higher sensitivity because she was presented with lots of evidence that when it comes to clinical results, patient care, that is, there is no difference in sensitivity. If the court has no further questions, oh, maybe I should say, mention something about Turner really quickly, because there was this statement, so they pointed to the Turner presentation.
The German breast group.
Pardon?
The German breast group.
Exactly, slides. Exactly. And actually, that points the exact opposite direction, because that Turner study was simply of radar. It wasn't of Signatera. And so when they pointed out that when it says, oh, don't use Signatera, they really meant don't use radar for it. And we actually argued below and pointed it out during the hearing that type of confusion where somebody has a problem.
It's a typo?
It's just a mistake. Now, they argued otherwise in the district court orally, but pointed out that this study, if you look at it, it's only studying radar. It's not studying Signatera. So it's hard to see how this could be, this statement they're saying that Signatera doesn't work particularly well, could have been truly a statement of Signatera when all they were studying was radar. And so that type of harm, someone saying bad things about your product or the risk of people saying bad things about your product because they're dissatisfied with a copycat, even that risk is irreparable. And it's irreparable harm for the whole market because people lose faith in the products as a whole and in the market as a whole. The court has no further questions.
Just a quick question. ctDNA stands for circulating tumor DNA.
That's correct.
So is this claim directed to ctDNA and not more broadly cfDNA?
So it is cfDNA and then it says associated with cancer. And I think for present purposes, everybody, the district court understood. I don't think it's been litigated that it's anything but ctDNA at this point.
I'm trying to figure out from your view, this is a ctDNA-directed claim?
So I think it'd be premature to go and do a claim construction because we're about to do claim construction.
Just trying to find out what your side's view is of what your claim is directed to.
I think it's been assumed to this point in this that was the case because the district court said, distinguished between cfDNA and said these statements were not discussing circulating tumor DNA. I think also likewise they started with CAPR, which was tumor DNA.
So you have no objection to it being understood as ctDNA driven?
For this point, yes. It is directed specifically to ctDNA. It's cell-free DNA associated with cancer. It's going to be ctDNA. It's circulating tumor DNA.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah.
Just to be clear, I mean, I think that they did argue, and I'm trying to find where in their brief, that these claims are not directed to the tumor inhibiting. Yeah, right. Am I wrong about that?
So, I'm sorry. So it's certainly limited to cell-free DNA associated with cancer, which is going to be circulating tumor DNA. Because that word's associated with cancer, the SNPs have to be associated with cancer. And the question is?
Tumor effective.
Tumor informed?
Tumor informed.
Okay. Oh, whether
tumor
or not
informed. That's a subset yet because you're designing your the things you're trying to make up from the patient's own sample, right?
Right. Whether or not you could, yes. So I don't think it's this particular patent, unlike the 454, is not limited to tumor-informed because you could use the patent, for example, the technique to say, here's a panel of tumors across the universe that we see about people in the United States, and do we find SNPs that are associated with that? That's
okay.
Fine.
So to make sure that we're all on the same page, the 035 could be related to ctDNA in terms of the way the claim articulates associated with cancer, but not be limited to tumor-informed testing.
That's correct. It's, it has to be circulating tumor DNA.
They're not one and the same, and like Judge Toronto said, tumor-informed testing is a subset of...
Yes, tumor-informed and tumor-naive. You know, the tumors that everybody in the universe gets versus the tumor that you yourself had.
Okay.
It covers both.
It's not just can be directed to. It is directed to ctDNA.
Yes.
Okay.
It is limited to cell-free DNA associated with cancer, which is going to be circulating tumor DNA. If the court has no further questions, thank you, the court, for its patience this time.
And Ms. Mayor, we'll give you 2 minutes of rebuttal. I'm just kidding.
You've had enough. So just really quickly, so I would like to point you in our preliminary...
But Shen's trying to leave. I mean.
He's doing his Chief Justice Rehnquist invitation. So in our preliminary injunction opposition in the district court, which is at, you can find it A10489-90, we cite Dr. Van Ness's, our expert's declaration, where he walks through the specific admissions that Natera has made in the past, including in CARE DX and in other cases. And then, so that in particular, in response to something, Mr. Lampkin said, at A12591 is a portion of the CARE DX summary judgment brief that Natera filed, where Natera admits that using circulating tumor DNA to tag, amplify SNPs and sequence was routine. So I disagree with his assertion that they haven't admitted in this context circulating tumor DNA for SNPs. I think we already talked about he's making the argument that the 25 to whatever in the claim is the invention here, but the patent itself acknowledges that it can be done with higher numbers, even in the passages that Mr. Lampkin pointed to. And the colloquy they had with you earlier, Judge Toronto, where Dr. Metzger, their expert, admitted, and there's the slide to the district court where we show, admitted that the Fluidigm 2010 patent application shows over 9,000 in a single well. So it's just their split and pool thing. The CAPR does not limit it to 10 in a well. It was just what they were doing, but it doesn't limit it to 10. The studies he talked about at the end in the Moshkevitz declaration, at A7932, that's not an apples-to-apples study that he's pointing to. It's also apples-to-oranges. One was early-stage cancer and one was not. So the district court made no findings in the PI, in support of her PI, about sensitivity, and only made the statement in the stay denial that it was not at all clear. But again, this was their burden, and they have no evidence to show that ours isn't more sensitive. They have no head-to-head study showing that. So... and they haven't shown there are no non-infringing alternatives. If you have no further questions, Your Honor, thank you.
I thank both counsel. It was an excellent argument.